The Uyghurs, a Muslim minority ethnic group of 12 million in Xinjiang in northwest China, have become arguably the most surveilled and perhaps the most detained people ever. New Zealand's investment in companies linked to the human rights violations of Uyghurs has been the subject of a stuff investigation, and household goods, clothing, cars available here have been linked to the forced labour of Uyghur people. It's been estimated that up to 2 million of them have been detained in prisons and detention centres, and state labour schemes include hundreds of thousands more. It's all part of a scheme which has made Xinjiang a laboratory for digital surveillance and control. Darren Byler is an anthropologist. He's based at the University of Boulder, Colorado, and he has studied repression in Xinjiang, and he's with me now. Hello.
Hello.
Let me just respond to a couple of listeners who, when I described the Uyghurs as possibly the most surveilled people ever, they have raised the Palestinians vis-a-vis Israel. And I don't know whether you've studied those, but I know that you have examined the dispossession of stateless populations. And I wondered if you had any comment.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between the kinds of surveillance that confront the Palestinians and the forms of surveillance that are used on the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs, though, don't really have an autonomous space of their own at all. The Palestinians have some forms of autonomy in the West Bank, I imagine. It's mostly when they move between spaces where they go through checkpoints. For the Uyghurs, there's border checks between every neighborhood. So imagine going through your airport security and having your face scanned and matched to the image on your ID 10 times a day. That's what a Uyghur person is confronted by. The state is really tracking their movements in all aspects.
Can you tell me about the evolution of this suspicion of the Uyghurs?
Sure. I mean, the Uyghurs are a native people to the space where they live in northwest China, a group of 12 million, as you said. And historically, they had their own homeland called East Turkestan in the 1930s and 40s. And so the state has always viewed them as sort of suspicious, as potentially a separatist group. And after 2001 and the global war on terror began, because Uyghurs are Muslim, that separatist suspicion was conflated with terrorism. So if Uyghurs protested forms of control, that was now labeled terrorism. And then eventually in 2013 and 14, there were some attacks carried out by Uyghurs on Han civilians that did meet the markers of what's internationally recognized as terrorism. And that's really what sparked what the Chinese state calls the People's War on Terror. And this new surveillance system began to be built around 2014 and 15.
Is it possible that China is right to suspect the Uyghur people of terrorism, even if it may be, in their view, freedom fighting because of the oppression and discrimination in the past on the part of China?
Well, I suppose every state has an obligation to protect its citizens from crime. And violence carried out by Uyghur civilians towards Han civilians, which happened in several incidents, should be met with, police investigations and justice. What's happening here, though, is not proportionate to the crime. There's, perhaps several hundred people, maybe 1,000 people that are involved in supporting actively and actually carrying out those violent incidents. What the state is doing here is something that they call a de-extremification campaign, which is preventative policing. It's stopping people from practicing Islam itself because they see Islam as the root cause of violence and of separatism. And so it's really about targeting an entire population of people rather than people that actually carry out crimes.
And we know that for a long time now, the Chinese government has been placing surveillance cameras throughout the country. How did that morph into, I mean, I read, maybe you can confirm or deny this, that equipment with facial recognition software has been used to the extent of ensuring that people take no more than 70 centimeters of toilet paper in certain public toilets in Beijing.
I think that is true in some cases, that there's a sort of automated toilet paper dispensing system that uses forms of computer vision. That's a kind of limited case in these, you know, public use facilities. The way that this evolved over time is the way it's evolved in many places. Back in 2010 or so, the state began to build out forms of surveillance throughout Chinese cities. And initially, these were actually, in many cases, installed by American or Western companies like Cisco or Honeywell. But over the next several years, Chinese companies like Hikvision and Dahua, they began to take on that role throughout the country. It really wasn't until 2014 and 15 when face recognition, where you could automate forms of surveillance in video to detect people's faces based on the shape of their face, their eyes, and their nose. It wasn't until 2014 or 15 that those capacities came online. And so what we're dealing with here is face recognition systems that are really quite new and really being used in this way for the first time. They're being used throughout China, but in the Uyghur region, they're being used at a much greater density. There's just so many more cameras. And then on top of that, there's these checkpoints where the people's IDs are checked. So that gives the state a firm timestamp of where that person was in time and space.
Do you know, is it possible to assess how many Uyghurs are in detention or re-education camps, I think that they're called, and what goes on there?
Well, there is some ways to assess that. It's not as transparent as we might like, since the state does not provide its, you know, data, transparent data, or access to these spaces. But over the last year, I've been looking at 52 gigabytes of internal police documents from the capital of the region, Urumqi. I've been working with a journal called The Intercept to go through these documents. And what it's showing in these documents is around 8-10% of the adult population of Muslims, which includes Uyghurs and Kazakhs and another group called the Hui, that they have been detained in forms of detention in the camps and in some cases in prisons. The state has released government documents concerning the numbers in prison, which is in 2017 and 18 combined 350,000 people. But it's clear from the police documents I'm talking about and other samples from across the region that it's probably close to 10 to 15% of the adult population that's been sent to camps. That would mean that around 1 in 6 adults have been put in a camp or a prison. Now, some of those camps have been closed in 2018 and 19. And so it's likely that there's slightly fewer numbers that are still in camps, but it's still a very significant number of people. And increasing numbers of those that were in camps are now in prison. And then, as you mentioned at the start of our conversation, many are being put in forms of forced labor or unfree labor.
So the re-education camps are for those who have committed no crime but are seen as in some way infected.
That's right. So the Chinese state has said in a government document that was submitted to the United Nations that those that were sent to the camp were those that had committed violations that didn't rise to the level of criminality. And so that means that they had done things that were technically illegal or had been illegalized, but they weren't deemed crimes that needed someone, you know, to be put into actual prison. Many of the people that were detained that I've interviewed, that I see in these police documents, were detained for digital crimes, for downloading WhatsApp on their phone, using a VPN, which allows them to escape the censorship system in China, of being part of a Quran study group online on WeChat. These are all things that in the past were not illegal. And even when they did these things were not illegal, they were illegal, made illegal years later. And that is why these people were detained. In the camps themselves, you know, it is a prison space. It's a medium security prison. People are behind barred, locked doors. They often have some form of education that's associated with the camp space, which means that they have a flat screen TV up on the wall and people are sitting on small plastic stools watching lectures from government leaders and Chinese language education. That's the majority of their time in the camp. In some cases, they're also given opportunities to go to a sort of fortified classroom where they're given more formal Chinese language instruction. But most detainees said that the educational component was really secondary. It was mostly about being in prison, being really scared.
You have spoken about the mass migration of Han Chinese into Xinjiang. And you have said that there is some evidence to suggest that women were being forced to marry Han Chinese in order to, I don't know, assimilate the Uyghur population. What's the evidence for that?
Well, so you have to understand that the Uyghur region is quite large. It's about the size of Alaska. So that means that different populations live in different areas. The Han population is mostly centered in the cities. And in the northern part of the region, while the Uyghurs live in rural areas in the southern part of the region. And as part of the re-education campaign, the camp system, the state sent over 1 million volunteers, and you should put scare quotes around volunteers because they were actually somewhat forced to do this work, to go into the villages and monitor the families that remained outside of the camp. So mostly they were targeting the family members of people that had been sent to the camps. And now because the camps, the camp population is around 60 to 70% men, it means that there's quite a few families who are missing, you know, a father and husband, which means there's these single women that are receiving these Han volunteers in their home. Many of those volunteers are men. One of my interviewees who I interviewed in Kazakhstan in 2020 said that in her village, the men would come to the women's homes, and it would bring a lot of stigma and shame to them. The men would often force them to drink alcohol, and at times there was sexual violence. Sometimes it was implied, and it's not clear that it was actually happening, but the women felt it as a form of sexual violence, even if it wasn't actually fully there. In some cases, we also see evidence that these women divorced their husbands that were sent to the camps. And in some cases, they married men that were sent into their villages. It's not clear what the scale is of that. It's just something that is evidently happening. But there's still a lot more evidence to be uncovered.
Have you received any response or pushback of any kind from China or the Chinese government to what you're saying?
Sure. The Chinese state has a very different narrative about the camp system and the other things that I've been describing. They describe it, of course, as counterterrorism and as these, and the camps as vocational training schools or centers. They haven't really formally acknowledged the sexual violence that we were just discussing, but I'm sure that they would deny that as well. What is clear from government interviews and documents is that marriages between the Han men and Uyghur women was celebrated by the state. You can see many kind of local level write-ups about this new marriage that had happened between a Uyghur woman and a Han man. And they often, gave those couples money as sort of compensation for consummating the marriage.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you. Are you going to continue your work in this area?
Well, it's much more difficult to do research in the region because of the political situation. So most of my work going forward will be in Kazakhstan. As people come across the border, I'm able to interview them there. And that helps me to triangulate with the government documents that I'm also reviewing and my past experience living in the region, exactly what's going on the ground. It's difficult work, but it's important, and I'll keep going with it.
Appreciate your time. Thank you, Darren Byler, who's a University of Colorado anthropologist.